Sounds like the Jason Derulo guy.
You know the Jason Derulo guy? Are you talking about the meme where he goes like Jason Derulo?
Yeah, like all of that, like that late 2000s production quality.
Yeah, that kid went to my school.
What? That's crazy.
Or wait, no, you're talking about wait, are you talking about actual Jason Derulo?
Yes. Oh, do you mean the
Okay.
Vine? The Jason Derulo Vine?
Yeah, I'm talking about the
Okay.
Vine. The kid went to my school
No,
in the
no, no.
Vine.
Yeah, like in like 2008 when like things would be like I don't know, they'd say like the name of the recording studio and be like, recording live, and then they say like Jason,
Oh,
hello, like
I
before the song
see.
actually started.
Yeah, no, I you just meant, that's why I was confused. I was like, the Vine doesn't sound like that.
If you look up like Jason Derulo had, that was like he was like one of the big ones. He always did that kind of like
Okay.
little like preambles to the actual song where he just says his name.
I mean, DJ Khaled still does that.
Yeah, there we go.
Anyways, that'll probably get cut. I don't know. Who knows?
Bonus material.
How do we introduce this?
I guess one of us, I don't know, do you want to say like vaulting the vault this time, or since this is not technically, this is like a pilot?
Yeah, I'll explain it. I'll explain what
Okay,
we're doing here.
yeah.
Okay, so welcome to Vaulting the Wall, a direct to sequel podcast. But as you can see, this episode isn't a sequel and it's not direct to video, so it doesn't really make sense why we're doing it.
Like all great pilots, it will differ greatly from the rest of the show.
Yeah, and who kn the quality might be better or worse, who knows? It could be
Who's
like
to say?
Arrested Development. Arrested
Yeah.
Development has a great pilot. So basically we picked The Fox and the Hound because we were like, oh, that's like a Dark Ages Disney. We can just do that as a test run, but then we didn't realize just how
Yeah.
much context there is to this.
So much context. I suggested it thinking that it was like, oh, a Dark Ages thing. Nothing. I mean, yeah, Dark Ages, not much going on, forgetting that this movie is in some ways key to understanding animation history for the next 20 years.
Yep, and I knew that going in also. I definitely knew that. I wasn't just like, what the fuck's this dumb Fox movie? But then I watched it and I liked it.
It holds up. Yeah. Was this your first time watching
Yeah, no, I haven't seen most like pre-Renaissance Disneys, if I'm being honest.
Oh yeah, I mean not a lot of people have. Well, I mean I guess. It's
Yeah.
hard for me to I think I grew up with a lot of people who were very into Disney, but I mean the Renaissance is really like the key text. Not a lot of people get into the Dark Ages.
Yeah. So that's what we're doing, even though that is not the concept of this podcast. This podcast is about direct to video sequels to Disney movies. So I'm sure we'll talk about that more on the next episode, but for now, we're just going to do Fox and the Hound as a test run. And how should we kick this off?
I guess we could start with some context of like where the studio was
Okay.
going into Fox and the Hound. Yeah. So Fox and the Hound, 1981. Which the last movie before that was 4 years earlier, The Rescuers, which was a big hit. But ever since The Jungle Book, which was the last movie Disney worked on, the studio, at least in my perception, and I think most people agree too, that ever since The Jungle Book, the studio had kind of been swinging more misses than hits,
Yeah.
especially as we get into the 80s. The 80s are really like the true darkest part of the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
That's when it gets real sweaty around Walt Disney Animation Studios.
Because what you got stuff like what is it like Oliver and Company?
Yeah, 80s is pretty much, I mean, Fox and the Hound kicks it off. Then we got the Black Cauldron, Great Mouse
Yeah.
Detective, which that is like, I think I saw it once as a kid, but I truly remember so little of it. That's kind of like the one Disney movie I know very little about. But I know people really do out like it. It's kind of being reclaimed at the moment, I believe. But yeah, then Oliver and Company, and Little Mermaid, which of course kicks off the Renaissance. But
yeah,
the rest of the it's not great. Disney's not doing too great.
No, it's not.
It's a lot of stagnation, and part of that might be because of what happens during the production of Fox and the Hound, which we'll get into.
We could do it now, because I'm assuming you hinted to me beforehand that like this was a very important text in the Disney canon, and then when I went on Wikipedia, I saw it and I was like, oh, that must be, is this what you were referring to, that this was the last film that involved the remaining members of Disney's Nine Old Men? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, kind of the Nine Old Men. From what I've read, the production is kind of a battle between the old guard and the new guard. There's kind of like three main events that I've picked out that kind of point to the issues I think this had, and also going forward, right? So like you said, this is the last movie to have involvement from one of the Nine Old Men, which for listeners who don't know, were these basically like the nine top animators in Disney for the first few decades. They all worked on Snow White and Pinocchio and various projects after that.
Right.
And Wolfgang Reithart, right? Reitherman.
Mm-hmm. Reitherman.
My bad.
Yeah.
Was at first one of the co-directors of Fox and the Hound, along with Art Stevens, who was part of, he was slightly younger. There's only like a 6-year gap between them, but there were still a perceived like kind of old versus new guard between them. They were co-directors and they butted heads quite a lot on the production, to the point where Reitherman left, saying, you know, this is, I guess animation is a young man's game and I'm no longer young.
Well, didn't Reitherman also have some crazy ideas for this?
He did. He at one point he thought, so we'll get into the plot of the movie. But I mean, this was also before Disney really kind of had unpacked a very good musical formula. I think generally when you see a lot of, when you watch a lot of the older movies, there are songs. So in a way they are musicals, but they're not musicals in a way that are necessarily plot beneficial.
Yeah, that's what I've noticed a lot. I think that's why Renaissance is held in such high regard, is because even watching Fox and the Hound, which is just, you know, what, like 8 years before Little Mermaid, there's more songs to it, but it's kind of, they're kind of just in there sometimes, right? Like, yeah, they're just kind of hanging like, around.
There's not like a villain song, there's not an identifiable they want song. Like, yeah, Little Mermaid is the first Disney movie to really do that, and that kind of kickstart, or a lot of people point to that as revitalizing the formula.
Right. But yes,
sorry, so songs. He felt like this, like, I guess the second or I consider it the third act. The fox gets dropped. He wanted to add a song.
Can I say the name?
Yeah, you can say the name because it's hilarious.
He wanted to add a song called Scooby Dooby Doo, Let Your Body Turn to Goo.
It's actually two doobies. It's Scooby Dooby Dooby Doo, Let Your Body Turn to Glue or Goo, which is ridiculous. And it. Which we'll get into it a bit, but it would basically have been at the part when the fox is dropped off in this nature preserve after he's been raised by a human for his entire life and is terrified and doesn't know how to function in the wild, and then these two cranes would have come by, voiced by Phil Harris, who is kind of like the lead scat cat from Aristocats. That's kind of his well-known bit, and Charo, the Spanish singer, who goes coochie coochie. Okay. And they recorded it and everything. Yeah, and everybody else is like, we can't do this.
They recorded it.
Like, we cannot.
They had live action reference footage. They storyboarded it. Like, they got.
It was, yeah. I can't.
Like, the tone of this movie, like, just real quick, this tone, it's such like a melancholic, like, kind of like sad, like from the very beginning it's very sad.
It is. I think it's one of the saddest Disney movies, honestly. Like, people talk about Bambi, but this is just kind of like relentlessly sad.
Yeah, from the very opening, like, the tone is just set like this very, like, I don't want to say muddy because it sounds like negative, but it is like this forest with like just you know, these light blue credits, and it's all slow and like getting foggy. You in the atmosphere. Yeah.
And then it, right out the bat, it basically, this movie opens with like the scene from Bambi where his mom dies.
Yes.
Like there's no like, oh, you know, this is a fox and his mother. She's running for her life from some hounds with her child in her mouth.
Yeah. So let's just get into the plot. So it opens like that. And then it's followed by Big Mama the owl.
Big Mama.
finding him and being like, hey, what does she say to him? Does she sing a song?
That's the worst thing. I was watching this and I was like, I need to make note of like when they sing songs. And I didn't. And I'm severely regretting that because I can't remember any of the songs besides the one they sing Best of Friends, which is kind of like the centerpiece song.
Yeah.
And she sings a song when he's like, my best friend is a dog. And she's like, I don't know if that's a good idea.
Yeah. That's later.
Yeah.
I think we're having trouble remembering the very beginning because now that I'm remembering, there's not much dialogue. It's pretty much like animals just kind of in the forest for like a good probably 10-ish minutes for a movie that's only like what, an hour 20? That's a decent movie. Chunk.
Yeah. And yeah, I do remember that. I remember looking at the progress bar and being like, that was 5 minutes of straight, well, credits. I mean, any opening credits thing is in an older movie is to be expected, but just also like 5 minutes of straight fleeing from dogs. And I think she drops off her son by this fence post, assuming she can come back for him, I think.
I think that's the assumption.
And then Big Mama, you know, you hear the shot. And, you know, not great. So Big Mama comes and she's like, oh, got this baby.
Yeah.
And we quickly also meet the two birds who are kind of the comic relief for this movie.
Yes, they're our comic relief. They're chasing a caterpillar, right?
Yeah, but it's confusing because early they call him a worm and they don't call him a caterpillar till later.
Well, worms are pink and this bug is green, so...
He looks like a caterpillar, but like for the first solid half of the movie, they only refer to him as a worm. I'm just being picky, but...
But basically, they concoct this plan to get the farmer woman, I don't know, what's her name?
The Widow Tweed.
Widow Tweed, they concoct this plan to like get her to notice the fox, and then she kind of adopts him.
She does, yeah. I mean, if I found a baby fox without a mother, I don't know if I would take it in. But like the instincts are there. I get that. And I guess Reitherman first picked up it was either Reitherman or Stevens, who was the second director or the other co-director who was a bit younger, picked or optioned Fox and the Hound as a book for a movie because he had foxes growing up, like as a kid or like with his kids.
which is that allowed?
I don't know.
I don't think it is. I mean, I guess I don't know where he grew up.
60s, yeah.
Like, I can buy that this woman can just be like, I found a fox and now it's mine.
Right. Oh, and it's like also, I don't know, it's like the early 20th century, about probably somewhere in the Ozarks. I don't know. You did more research into the book. Do they ever say like where it's set?
Yeah, the book is, well, the book's very different if you want me to talk about that. The book.
Yeah, maybe go into the book bit.
The book is set like in this sort of time, but over the progress of them growing up, it like evolves into a more modern age.
Huh.
And that's like part of the book, apparently, is like this idea of like he has less and less like hiding abilities because there's more and more cities and like people encroaching on nature. And it's very different in terms of like, because like the hunter, Copper's owner is an alcoholic.
Oh, geez.
Book ends very different, if I can just say this real quick. It just ends with Todd just dying from literal exhaustion and Copper laying on him, and it's like they've finally finished what has been going on, and the hunter comes and nurses Copper back to health, but then nothing changes. Like, they do this all as a big revenge plot because the fox got Chief killed in the book. Yeah, right. So they
that's
do it all
a
as
big a big thing to the production, the lore,
kind of the story of like, well, what did that really do for you? Because the hunter's still an alcoholic, Copper is like scarred for life.
Right. I mean, there's a great or Mary Ness did a great series. She's a freelance writer, I believe, but she did a great series on tor.com about looking at all the movies that Disney has adapted from source material. And her like kind of main thesis out of all of it is that Disney gets its hands on source material and just changes it almost completely. And this is no different.
I don't think this has any of the real themes of the book. I think the book has more themes of like, you know, like advancement of time and things like this book, this movie kind of just ends with like, man, isn't it sad they can't be friends?
Also, they're still kind of friends. It's like a bittersweet ending. I kind of thought of it like the John Mulaney bit, where he's talking about his dad, and he's referencing another movie that I can't remember what it is at the moment. But he's like, you know, you have your law cases, and I have my coloring books or whatever, or coloring crayons. You know, like I live in the forest and have this hot wife, and you are a hunting dog.
I guess since I touched on the death a bit, I guess we should. I think that's the next big thing, really, is like, you know, they're friends, and then.
Oh wait, we should go back a little bit because there is some. The Widow Tweed adopts Todd. And that's great. And he's a mischievous little fox because he is a wild animal. He accidentally chases some chickens and, you know, he gets into mayhem.
Very cute.
A bit. It's cute. You know, it's a Disney movie. We like to see baby animals playing around. And speaking of baby animals, her next door neighbor, Amos, is it Amos Slade?
It is. Yeah, Amos Slade.
He has also, he's a hunter, right? He's kind of, he lives in more of a shack situation. He already has a dog named Chief, and he comes home with a new hound dog puppy named Copper.
Yep.
Who is adorable.
He is very cute. He's very, what type of dog is he? Do you know?
He's a bloodhound.
Bloodhound. Okay, yeah. They have so much extra, like, fat on their body.
They do. They got the rolls. And he has, like, the longest ears that he's, like, stepping on and stuff.
I think he even says that to Chief. He's like, why are your ears so short?
Yeah. And one day, Todd, while, you know, he can't looking for some stuff to play, the birds will not play with him because they're still chasing after that caterpillar.
Yeah.
So he kind of wanders over and meets Copper. And so it's like, hey, want to play?
Yeah.
And Copper is like, yeah, sure. And they do.
And there's a sweet little song, which...
It's a sweet little song.
Kind of like the centerpiece, right?
I'd say so. I think a lot out of the many things of this movie, that's one of its lasting legacies is that song. Like that's, I think most people who have seen it remember the song.
Yeah. But again, it's weird because, you know, it's not like other Disney musicals. It just kind of plays over them.
Oh, it's like a montage. Yeah. And it's very quick because, I mean, the montage could, I feel like they could have implied that the montage happens over several days, maybe some weeks, you know, like, oh, they've been friends for longer than a day. But then it cuts back and it's implied that it's been like a few hours.
Yeah, that's the time of this movie, I think, is one of the most confusing parts to me.
Okay. Yeah, I can get that. I guess it's because like animals just age so fast.
Yeah, that might be it. Because like they're like, oh man, they're leaving. Well, I think that's the next part, isn't it? That they're leaving for a winter hunt.
Yeah, well, so there's some activity between them because... Well, basically, this montage plays of, you know, them being the best of friends, and it's presumably only been an afternoon.
Yeah.
And Todd is like, hey, we're best friends, right? And Todd's like, or Copper is like, yeah, of course, forever. And they're like, cool, got that down. and then Copper has to go home because he wasn't supposed to wander off. And then the next day, Todd comes back to play.
Oh, right,
but
yeah.
Copper has been tied up because he wandered off, and he wakes up Chief and chases some more chickens by accident, and Amos is basically livid and tries to kill him because he's a fox.
Right, okay, I forgot about this. Yeah, Chief is, like, tied to the barrel. He's chasing Todd with the barrel.
Right, comedy ensues. And then shortly after that, Amos is like, you better keep that fox away from my farm.
Yeah.
Which puts a bit of a damper on the budding friendship between Todd and Copper. And the widow, he tells the widow Tweed to keep him inside.
Well, and the Todd's also, I mean, he's kind of, he's the little instigator. Like, she even says, like, she keeps being like, wow, you're a fiery little fella. Like, and he just keeps going for it. It's like, that man's going to shoot you.
He is. Also, it's like a simultaneously thing of like, well, he is a wild animal, right? He's not, he's not domesticated in any way. So you're kind of like, well, this is to be expected. And like, I mean, he's like, it's a weird mashup of that and like just like the childlike innocence. Like he, I think even Copper is kind of like, hey, you know, maybe don't wake up Chief. Like he's scary. He's not instantly like, we can't hang out because you're a fox.
Yeah.
But everybody else is like, hey, Todd, maybe being best friends with the dog isn't the best idea.
Yeah.
And Todd's like, nah, I'm sure it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. We're best friends forever. Nothing will ever change that.
Well, and I, one thing this movie, I think, could have, I guess, juiced a little, like, sentimentality from is the fact that, like, what's her name? Big Mama should be like, hey, Todd, I witnessed your mother get killed by someone like that. But instead, they have a scene where it's, like, her just showing all the fox skins.
Yeah, which is disturbing.
Yeah, that's still disturbing. That's probably,
and it might be, I saw that, and I was like, damn, is one of those his mom?
Yeah.
It's not great. Yeah, this movie is certainly melancholic, but I mean, it's still a Disney movie. Like, it doesn't take out all the punches, I guess.
Yeah.
On making you feel sad.
Is the next part when they go on the hunt?
Yeah, so Todd is basically like, or, you know, Widow Tweed is like, Todd, you have to stay indoors so Amos doesn't shoot you. But then it doesn't really matter anyways because it's fall now. And they're going on a big hunting trip.
Yeah. And this is where the big time jump happens. Is I think you see another montage, right? Of them hunting?
You get a montage of Copper and Chief and Amos out hunting. It's basically like the entire winter. Like they're gone for a whole season because they don't come back until the spring.
Yeah.
And you also get a montage of the caterpillar messing around. Gotta have that. Gotta have your slapstick side. I know you guys care about the dog and the fox, but
you gotta see those birds.
Caterpillar too, right?
And I think the caterpillar gets in and sitting by the fire and warming himself up.
The birds are like, oh, crap. I guess we should fly south for the winter now. It's already snowing.
We might have missed our chance because we were chasing this stupid bug.
Not like there's other bugs. We just want this one caterpillar. More importantly, Copper goes on his first big hunting trip, and it's like this is the place where you're going to learn how to be a hunting dog.
Yeah, and Chief sets up that he can't sit in the front right before they go. He hasn't mm-hmm. earned it yet, and he goes mm-hmm. off for the long winter.
When Todd does say goodbye, he manages to kind of sneak out and be like, "Bye, see ya."
Yeah,
see you in a bit. Best friends forever, right?
And then the big time jump happens.
There's a montage. It's snowing. Copper is shown to be maybe, you know, getting some ground on Chief, who's a bit older. But yeah, and you know, during the montage, like he grows from a small puppy that could maybe fit in your pocket to like a medium-sized puppy. This is like their teenage years.
And the biggest growth he experiences is he, instead of sounding like Corey Feldman, starts to sound like Kurt Russell. Oh,
no, it's crazy. Dog puberty is just wild. Kurt Russell, I feel like, is the best cast. I don't know if it's like the best casting because I think Pearl Bailey, who plays Big Mama, is doing a lot of. She's doing great, but like Ricky or Mickey Rooney,
yeah.
Mickey Mooney plays. Let me get his name right.
Todd.
Mickey Rooney is playing Todd, who at this time Mickey Rooney was old. He was elderly, I think.
Yeah.
He's getting on in his age, which doesn't, I mean, it sounds fine, but you're kind of, I don't know, in my head, the idea of like young Kurt Russell.
Yeah. That's fair.
And Copper. And Mickey Rooney is a bit strange.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. One of the notes I wrote was weird hearing Kurt Russell as a dog. just because I'm not used to Kurt Russell as a dog.
That is, we don't often see him as a dog. Has he done any other dog roles? And it's strange. Disney didn't like think about casting him until they saw his work on Elvis, the TV movie biopic directed by John Carpenter.
Weird. You know, yeah, okay. Yeah. I assumed Fox and the Hound was like early Kurt, because I know he was like a child star.
This is post-child star.
Yeah, this is... Wait a minute.
And he was a child star for Disney. And Disney was like, we can invite Kurt back.
Fox and the Hound takes place... It came out the same year as Escape from New York. That's some insane to me.
Double feature 1981 Kurt Russell films, Escape from New York and The Fox and the Hound.
Yeah, then next year he'll be in The Thing. You know, oh, kids, you liked Fox and the Hound? You liked Copper? Let's go watch The Thing.
Exactly. That's like the fun kind of still relevant celebrity casting. I guess Corey Feldman, I recognize his name. I was like, Corey Feldman as young Copper as well.
Do you know about Corey Feldman? Do you know what he's become?
What has he become?
You know,
I recognized his name, but I didn't.
He was like, in the 80s, he's in like Gremlins, Lost Boys, Goonies, things like that.
Okay, yeah. Okay, now I'm looking at the Wikipedia page and I see his personal life section. With its multiple subsections. Okay. Yeah. That's why I've heard his name.
Yeah. He now states that he's reincarnated Michael Jackson.
Oh, boy.
And he, even though he was alive when Michael Jackson was still alive, so Corey, yes. You need some explaining on that one. But he makes like all these music videos of him like doing like the Michael Jackson thing, and it's just he's insane. That's all you can really say about Corey Feldman.
Okay. Yeah. So shit, where are we? All right, let's see. So he comes back, he's a hunting dog. Todd is still kind of still convinced that they're gonna be best friends forever because that's what they said.
Yeah.
It almost likens to like the trope of someone leaving for summer camp and coming back totally changed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, you come back and your best friend like popular and has boobs now and are still.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't think Todd got boobs.
No. I just feel like that's been a thing in like Lizzie McGuire. Yeah. You know, it's like the trope, like, my best friend went to summer camp and now they won't talk to me.
Yeah.
But this is worse. My best friend went to winter camp.
And hunts and my now, kind.
Wants to kill me. Yeah. But Todd immediately is like, gotta go see my best friend, Copper. And he goes, and Copper is immediately like, dude, I don't think this thing is gonna work anymore.
Yeah.
And it's like the middle of the night, but Chief and Slade still wake up and chase him. It gets worse this time, no? Like, it's kind of more of a threat to his life.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, this is, yeah, you go, because this is what you've wanted to get to for a while now.
Yeah, it's just because this is like the most memorable, like to me, this is the most memorable because I was like, oh my gosh, because this is probably the like most abruptly dark part of the movie when they chase him this second time and you get, you know, you get like just kind of similar to earlier, just him chasing, but this time less cartoony. It starts to rain, does it not?
It's raining. It's not just before they were chasing around the yard, like there's kind of chicken tomfoolery happening. This time they're out in the wilderness.
And this time
that kind of surrounds them.
Copper comes to Todd and he's conflicted because he found him.
He finds him immediately because he's a good dog.
Yeah, and he's like, I don't know, but he's like, I'll let you go this one time.
This one time.
Yeah, and so
which is crazy.
Yeah. Like, it just shows, like, the time jump there. Like, how before, you know, they were like, oh, maybe. But now he's, like, conflicted on even just letting him go once.
And he's like, well, I guess I'll not kill you this one time.
Yeah.
And then you basically, and he escapes for very briefly before Chief finds him.
Yes. They get to a a railway track. And
above a ravine.
Yeah. And Chief catches Todd by surprise. They run on these tracks and then a train a train comes out of nowhere. Yep. Literally nowhere. I was looking at my phone for a second, and then the train came. I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
You hear like a little like toot toot in the distance, and you're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Shit's about to go down.
Todd, because he's tiny, just kind of crumples up.
Kind of flattens down, yeah.
Chief gets hit and falls off the side of this mountain, hitting.
Does he hit or does he just jump?
No.
Or is it just kind of vaguely unclear because it's a children's movie?
I think he jumps because you hear the you hear the hunter.
Slade,
yeah, okay. Slade yells.
Jump.
Yeah.
Jump, chief. Yeah.
And then he falls and hits like his head on the rocks, I think. And his body like tumbles down to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh my gosh, are they going to kill this dog? But he opens his eyes a little bit. So you're like, oh.
So more production woes. This was like a second big thing. Besides trying to write in a existential song about bodies turning to goo.
Scooby dooby dooby do, let your body turn goo.
Body turn to goo, yeah. This was a lot of the younger animators really wanted Chief to die. They were like, this movie doesn't work if Chief doesn't die, right? Because after this is when Copper is like, I should have never let Todd go. Next time, I'm not holding back. Whereas, I kind of agree, like, if Chief doesn't die...
I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah. He should die. Kill that dog.
Right? Because then you... I mean, like, kind of like, he breaks his leg, and there's kind of some fun... Or it's not really fun. It's fine. Like, of him like kind of moping around the house being like, my leg's broken. It's fine. I guess it pads it out a little bit, having that like few minutes a piece of him being a pampered dog as opposed to living in a barrel in the yard.
You get like a couple fine jokes out of it. And that's
it's not, but it's not worth it for like Copper to be like, who's ambivalent to then be like, oh, you broke my like father dog or like my brother dog's leg.
Yeah,
I have to kill you now. Like if it's death, it's a lot more like the stakes racketeer up. Like it's so much higher.
I think it makes his I think it makes his turn to hating Todd make a lot more sense if Chief dies.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was another big thing that like the younger animators, I think. Oh, hold on. I think it was Glenn Keane, but it might have been Musker instead. So also, maybe you finish up developer, like production talk as well. I have a list here of people who worked on this film who like later went on to kind of become big names in animation. You have John Lasseter, John Musker, Ron Clements, Glenn Keane, and the Musker, Clements, and Keane really become big guys in the Renaissance.
Yeah.
You also have Tim Burton, Brad Bird, and Henry Selick, the last of which I feel like he's a lesser known name, but he's the one who's working on Nightmare Before Christmas. He does James and the Giant Peach. And then perhaps like the most important out of this group at this time, at least, is Don Bluth. So basically you have this like insane crop of animators coming in to work and on this film specifically, and they don't all break away because of this film, but a fair number do. So Brad Bird gets fired halfway through.
Huh.
Yeah. And he then leaves Disney and goes to do things in television, and he doesn't get back till Pixar. I mean, I assume this is where he met John Lasseter, who was also on the movie. But yes, so you have this amazing crop of animators who will go on to do industry-changing things later. And the big one is Don Bluth, who, I guess, from what I read, the one scene he kind of led on, or at least one that we know about, is the scene when Todd is a child and the Widow Tweed is milking a cow.
Oh.
Like Don Bluth led. Do you know the Don Bluth background?
No, I don't.
Do you know anything about Don Bluth?
I know the name.
Okay. No worry. I mean, he's kind of not entirely niche, but basically Don Bluth, after he led a revolt during his production, basically being like, this is ridiculous, and especially in regards to Wolfgang Reitherman, the way he was running things, and kind of like he said he was leaning over the younger animators' shoulders because he didn't trust them. He and I think like 13 or like a dozen so animators quit halfway through production on Fox and Hound because they're so unhappy. And Don Bluth then immediately goes to found his own studio, which during the 80s kind of continues to kick Disney's butt repeatedly.
Yeah.
So he did, in the 80s, he did Secret of Nim. Trying to think. I think Thumbelina was the 90s, but he's kind of known for like these other animated movies during the 80s that are...
And Before Time,
yes. Like, he's that guy. Rockadoodle, I believe. Is he Rockadoodle?
Very, very 80s and 90s.
All Dogs Go to Heaven, American Tale. Did I already say that? But he's... Right. So he had been at Disney since Sleeping Beauty.
Huh. I didn't know
and
that.
And he was just kind of... Yeah. And he was just kind of fed up. And he and the animators who left weren't credited. So that's why, like, you don't see Don Bluth or Brad Bird even credited on the in the credits for Fox and the Hound.
I knew Brad Bird, like, knew the nine old men. Like, that was, like, his thing. They brought him in. They're like, you're going to be the guy. I didn't even know he worked on this. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, this was, I mean, I'm sure you've listened to the Blank Check episode, which... The podcast that brought us together. But yeah, he was kind of this whiz kid, and he was unhappy with the way the animation was being run at Disney, and was kind of like, this is enough. And they're like, well, you can leave then.
Yeah. Well,
which is also, John Lasseter doesn't leave on this project, but he kind of goes over some higher ups' heads to get started on a project based on where the Wild Things are. They rejected because they went over his head, and then they're like, okay, now you can leave.
Huh.
So there's a lot of kind of like the old guard basically not having anything. It's I guess stagnation is really the best way to say it.
Yeah, this is interesting. Yeah. This is a very important movie.
It is. Yeah. Tim Burton, I think I've read somewhere, I couldn't find it again, but Tim Burton, this and Black Cauldron are the two movies that convinced Tim Burton to leave animation.
Wow.
Yeah. I
think you could kind of feel it in the movie, because it does, like we keep saying, it has like a sad tone. The reason it never gets to the point where it's like completely dark is because it's like fighting, you know?
Yeah, and I can't even imagine if they had included the Scooby Dooby Doo or Dooby Dooby Doo song, how even more of that would have been felt between kind of this movie at odds with
I feel
itself.
A lot of the more like classic Disney things in this movie kind of subtract from it, like the antics with the bird and the caterpillar. I'm like, we don't need this in this movie.
And that's something, I mean, it's kind of fresh in my mind because I just rewatched it. But that's also something that happens in Aristocats a lot. You have the two dogs who mess around with Edgar, the villain in that movie, which is totally, it just pads it out, which is saying something, which is totally unnecessary to the plot. And it's just kind of like, well, I guess, yeah, it's just slapstick nonsense that really doesn't add to the plot. And Disney does find a way to do that. And they did find a way to add kind of slapstick comedic relief in earlier films. But by this point, it just feels perfunctory.
Well, that's why I love 101 Dalmatians, is because it all feeds in. You get slapstick from those two like gorilla thugs, but they're still connected to the plot.
Yeah, they're still there for a reason, for a substantial reason. And I think I do say the birds do have some more effect on this movie than like the two dogs in Aristocats.
Yeah.
That's a different movie.
I just think this movie is darker and wants to go darker. And
yes.
I think there'd be a lot less bird stuff if they...
Yes.
The younger voices were heard more.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, Chief would have died in this alternative. I was supposed to look up who complained. Hold on. Let me.
As I always say, there would be less birds if they let the bird, Brad Bird, have his way.
There you go. Okay, so it was Ron Clements who goes on to become like a leading name in the Renaissance, who has spoken out saying like Chief has to die. The picture doesn't work if he just breaks his leg. So that's that. But anyways, back to the plot. So I guess I feel like I've run out of all the kind of like fun production things from this, but
yeah.
Fox and the Hound, important text in understanding kind of animation from the 80s onward in a way.
No, all that is important. Like without that, you know, that's the stuff they're fighting about. Like I don't think the ending would change much if the younger people got their way. I think it would have more impact.
Yeah.
But ending, you know, that's all we really have left, right? Well, no, there's still a little bit more because there's the band.
Yeah, we're Or yeah, so okay, what happens? All right, so Copper got back. Todd says hi. They get into another fight. Chief breaks his leg. And that's, you know, that's kind of the last straw for Copper. And the Widow Tweed also realizes that she cannot like safely take care of Todd anymore. So she goes and drops him off in a nearby nature preserve.
This is another sad scene.
This is where the Scooby Dooby Dooby Doo song would have been.
I think the song they use instead is better. I don't think it would be as memorable as Scooby Dooby Dooby Doo.
Are there two songs here or just one?
There's the one of her like singing in her head, isn't there, when she drops him off?
Oh, yes, I think. Or is it just sad? This is a problem with the movie.
There's definitely,
we watched this like 2 days ago.
Yeah, there's definitely a song when she's taking him, but it's like from the perspective of being like in her head, because like the song will do something and then she'll react like looking at Todd, but she's not actually singing. And Todd is singing,
like, "Ooh, we're going on a ride." Yeah. Okay, yes. It's not diegetic. Okay. Yeah, and then he gets dropped off from the forest and is promptly kind of like, "What the fuck? Where am I?" This badger yells at him
multiple times.
He spends the night with a porcupine multiple times. He's like, "You need to get out or die." Does he say die? I think he implies it at least.
Yeah.
It's dark. And Big Mama is still there, and she's like, "Oh man, poor Todd."
So
the next day,
she says, "What Todd really needs is he needs a wife. We need to wife this man home."
He is a, and this is really like Fox and the Hound's counterpart to the Twitter-pated section of Bambi, or even it's like an owl being like, "Oh, you gotta fall in love."
Yeah, which
you say though, this has an advantage over Bambi in the fact that they do kind of like flirt, like there's a courtship, and Bambi, the girl just kind of comes up and she's like, "Hey, Bambi, let's get together."
Yeah, I don't like Bambi, but we could talk about that on the Bambi 2 episode. Is there a Bambi 2?
There is a Bambi 2. Okay. It is a midquel and it's something. Oh boy, Bambi 2. It's one of the midquels were interesting, but we'll get into that.
The things I don't like about him and the Lady Fox, in my notes, I wrote down Lady Fox eye roll emoji. then I wrote that he calls her an empty-headed female. I was like, this feels weird. He's just insulting this poor woman who wants to help.
Right. She's like, "Oh, who's this guy?" Well, she's even like, she doesn't even know he's there. Like, she's like just talking to Big Mama, and Big Mama's like, "Oh, there's a new fox in the woods." And she's like, "Oh, really?" Big Mama's like, "He's cute." She's like, "Oh, okay, gotta go. Gotta go help him right now."
Wait a minute, you said he's cute?
What? I thought he was an ugly fox. Never mind. Also, her name is Vixie, which is like a diminutive, I cannot say that word. It's like a nickname for Vixen, which is a female fox.
Yeah.
Which at this point I realized Todd is the name for a male fox.
Oh, wow.
Which in the movie, yeah, I know. In the movie they explain it as, he's like, when the Widow Tweed first picks him up, she's like, "You're like a little toddler."
Oh.
Which I guess works, but in real life, that's a male fox.
Imagine if you picked up a baby and you're like, "You look like a baby. I'm going to name you Babe."
Is that what happens in Babe, the pig movie? I haven't seen Babe.
Well, that's a little different too, because that's a pig. That's not a human.
Right. Okay, you're talking about like a real human.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought even like any baby of any species. Okay.
But anywho's, they start flirting. They go on some dates.
There's a song. Yeah. They hold tails together.
Yeah, they do that. Count birds together. And then
they move in.
Move in together. Big first steps in any relationship. Especially fox relationship.
Uh-huh. Big moves.
Then is this when the hunter and Copper come back?
So they've been plotting in the meanwhile. And the hunter introduces the concept of traps to Copper.
He's like, "Copper."
Which feels like something maybe would have been covered while on that big hunting trip they took.
He's like, "Copper, remember when I made you get all those animals on your own and I did nothing? Well, check out this thing that I can actually do. I have metal traps
that will break the legs of anything it comes into, basically." And Copper's like, "Hell yeah, we're gonna get this fox."
He's like, "We're gonna get that fox."
They see the Widow Tweed kind of drive him off, and he's like, oh, she's taken him to the nature preserve. So then they go to the nature preserve, and there's a scene where they get to the fence, and it says no hunting. And he goes, well, we're not really hunting. We're just getting a fox.
That's hunting. I'm sorry.
That's hunting. Yeah, they like, it's not even the point where it's like they've crossed an invisible fence. They get to like a barbed wire fence and cut it open with like wire cutters.
Yeah, it's definitely illegal.
Mm-hmm, very illegal. There's not any like real repercussions for that.
So yeah, they put down the trap, cover him in leaves. They hide him. He basically makes like a wall of just pure traps.
Yeah, there's like a hollow where they figure Todd will be. Oh right, it's right by the river. He says he has to come through to get to the water.
Yes, that's right.
And Vixie and Todd come up, and she's like, "Something's off. It's way too quiet." And Todd, ever the naive one, is like, "Nah, I'm sure it's fine."
Yeah, like any dumb guy is just like, "Nah, I want my water."
Yeah, and he goes through, and you know, it gets a bit tense, and I think he's immediately like, "Oh no." And he keeps conspicuously missing the traps.
Yeah.
Does he set one off by accident? And
I think
then,
that's it.
Or does like Amos like jump out at him?
I think he starts setting a couple off, and then they like you see them all going like, and he's like, "Oh no!"
He's like, "Oh shit! Oh shit! Oh shit!" Yeah, trying to save his legs, and then the second big chase. I guess third.
Yeah, the third chase. It's kind of muddled here. It's just like a big chase again. They end up like on a cliff, right?
Well, yeah, they do. But first, they run. This is again where I question Todd's like thought process. I don't know if like foxes actually do this in real life. But there's a kind of a whole thing where it's like, I'm a fox, I can outfox him, right? Like, you know, like the sayings go.
Yeah.
Foxes are supposed to be clever and sneaky. But he leads himself and Tracy to their burrow, and with Copper and Amos in pursuit. And there's a backside to the burrow, but Amos Copper's on the front side, Amos is on the backside, so they're trapped. And then Amos starts to smoke them out, so they have to leave through the front.
Right, and he nips at Copper.
Yes, he kind of like bats him. But this doesn't, it's kind of like, oh, this is it, they're going to be caught. But again, this doesn't do anything really.
Yeah.
Escape, and they're like, oh, they escaped! And then they get to the cliff. There's like a big waterfall, there's some rocks, and when they're looking for the foxes, what do they find instead?
A bear.
Uh-oh.
It's pretty scary. Don't
go hunting in the nature preserve. He's a scary bear. It's actually a Brave reference.
Oh.
Little known fact.
But yeah.
Same bear from Brave.
I think in the book, actually, I think that's when Copper proves himself, as he kills the bear in the book.
Okay, so he kills the bear.
And Chief's still around at this point. It's way earlier.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
They kind of rearranged that. But so the bear attacks him. Slade gets caught in one of his own traps.
Mm-hmm.
He falls down the cliff, and he leaves his gun on the side of the cliff. Well, it falls out of his hand. He doesn't leave it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't just like, oh, I'll set this down, come back to this later.
I gotta tie my shoe real quick.
No, he's actually falling to his death and falls into a trap.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a bear, and you think this might be the end of old Slade, but then Copper comes,
starts fighting the bear. He's not winning either, really.
Yeah.
Then Todd comes.
What does Todd do again? I don't.
This is like Copper is kind of like, oh, it's like me versus this bear. Todd is trying to get away. Like he's basically, he could just run away and save himself. But he sees Copper and Slade kind of helpless against the bear, and he goes attacks the bear. So he saves their life, even though at this point, I guess he gave him that solid. I guess Copper gave him that solid one in the second chase. But
yeah.
So he starts fighting the bear. They get kind of knocked around, end up on an old tree.
That might be why, because earlier I mentioned how it feels kind of dumb that Todd keeps being like, "Nah, Copper's my friend." That might be just part of it. It's just Todd is still convinced, like maybe this guy will be my friend if I fight this bear.
Yeah, the relationship is definitely one of like Copper being very on the fence about whether they can be friends, and Todd just like kind of having unwavering loyalty.
Yeah, I think he might see it like that, but it's not completely clear.
No, it doesn't come through very well because there's too much time spent on caterpillars.
What is this, A Bug's Life? anyway.
So many Pixar connections here. Yeah, and Todd, they end up on like a shaky old tree that's kind of spanning this chasm next to the waterfall. And because the bear is fucking massive, it breaks, and they both fall down into the river.
Yeah.
This kills the bear, presumably. We don't see the bear again.
Maybe the bear will come back in the sequel.
Maybe. Oh, wait, I regret to inform you that the sequel is also a midquel.
What's that mean?
So, I mean, we'll get to it eventually, but a lot of the Disney sequels, especially in like the mid-2000s, started turning... Basically, the movies where you couldn't have like a fun... No, I guess instead of like focusing on the children of the main characters, they pivoted towards focusing on chapters of the characters' lives that didn't get attention in the original movie.
So it's like a prequel?
It's like a midquel. So it happens like, you know how we're talking about like the montage where like they're the best of friends? It happens like sometime after that and before they go on the hunting trip.
Wow. Sounds great.
Which the movie is presented as like 2 days, but yeah, it gets... The midquels get a bit sweaty. I think that's the sweatiest.
Well, yeah, because you can't. I don't know what sequel you make to Fox and the Hound. I mean, that just goes back to the issue with our entire premise. You can't make sequels to a lot of this stuff.
No, right. They end in kind of like a finite way that doesn't want anything more. Right? It's like the classic Disney, the end.
Yeah. So
the end.
Anyway, speaking of endings, we're near the end of Fox and
the Hound. Near the end. We are.
Basically, doesn't Todd's previous owner find the hunter or something?
So that's at the very, very end. Oh. So Todd and the bear fall down this waterfall. The bear is not seen again. Todd, however, kind of washes up in like on the shore of this lake or pond or whatever it is. Not doing too hot, predictably. And Amos has gotten himself out of the trap and he's about to shoot Todd.
Oh, this is okay. Yeah,
to finish the job, and then Copper. I think this scene works pretty well. And Copper stands in front of him.
Yeah,
and says no. Well, he doesn't say no. He like barks it. But
yeah. It's a classic like standing up for your friend moment. Like right when you're like, oh no, and then he jumps in and you know proves to the hunter like, oh, like this fox matters a lot to my dog in some way that I don't understand.
Yeah. And I think Slade also by this point is kind of like, well, I guess this fox saved our lives.
Yeah.
So I won't kill him this time.
So then are we?
And then we cut to Slade is back at home. He's being cared for by the Widow Tweed.
Yes. And now he has a broken leg. And now Chief is like, you're a big baby. I had one.
Everything's back to normal, kind of. Well, not really. Well, this is the thing. Like, I guess this movie makes... I mean, it's a moral tale of being like, you know, you can be friends with people society says you shouldn't be friends with, right?
Yeah.
Then it also says maybe not.
Yeah, that's kind of my issue with this movie is it feels a little like you could be friends with people, but like you can't ever really like hang out with them. You live in your separate regions.
You know, like sometimes nature rules all because it doesn't end with the dog saving Todd's life and then being like, I'm never going to hunt again. But he's still going to hunt.
Yeah.
But
it's just Todd is the one that he'll protect. That's the only difference.
I guess. Yeah. Like, maybe he won't hunt foxes. Who knows? Yeah. So it ends. He's back at home and he's kind of like a content dog. And it zooms out and you see Todd and Vixie on like a ridge kind of overlooking the two houses.
Yeah. And
that's the end.
That's the end. And the movie... cost $12 million. It was the most expensive at its time of release, the most expensive animated movie. Isn't the most expensive now Tangled?
I think Tangled's been surpassed.
Oh.
Look it up, though. But it was also the highest grossing animated film at the time it was released.
Oh.
So there's that. I think it did pretty well. And I mean, it did well enough in, like, what's it called? Like, video... sales and stuff to warrant a sequel, which I mean, sometimes you look, especially even when I was a kid, I was like, they made a sequel to Fox and the Hound.
Yeah.
But I guess there are reasons why Disney decides to make sequels to the movies, or did decide to make sequels to the movies.
I'm still seeing Tangled as number one.
It's crazy. Wow. I didn't know that.
Huh. Well, it was worth it. All the money, worth it.
Tangled's a great movie.
Yeah, Tangled's great. We should, well, you know, forget the concept of the podcast. We're just going to watch Tangled.
Again and again and again. So I see Tangled is, right, Tangled's a lot, but I wonder how much The Lion King cost.
Lion King?
A new one, which is, in air quotes, not an animated movie.
Yeah, they don't consider that an animated movie because it's...
Okay, it's 25 to 26 million, so it's like the same. But, I mean, and it also made literally a billion dollars, so I guess it gets a pass.
I never saw it. But still haven't seen it.
I still haven't seen it, no. I'm getting to Lion King on my rewatch, and then maybe I'll watch the live action one for the first time.
Lion King, a movie I don't love.
It's hard to say. It's been a while for me. I think the last time I saw it was in theaters.
Really? I don't think.
In 1990? No, I'm kidding. Well, I mean, I did see. I think I saw it in like 2000. There was like a 3D re-release in 2000.
Oh, right. Yeah. I
12 or 11 or something.
But yeah, Fox and the Hound.
Strange movie.
strange movie. I don't know if I love it. This was one thing I was thinking when it started, is I just don't think I love when Disney's like, look at nature. Isn't nature beautiful? Like, they do the same thing with Bambi, and I'm just like...
Yeah, this is a big nature movie.
I love nature, don't get me wrong, but like, I don't know, I think I just... Color palette-wise, it always feels limiting, because it's just very green and brown.
Brown.
Yeah.
Autumnal at times. Yeah, I get that. I give it 3.5. I don't know. It's
I gave it three
better
and a
than
heart.
Other films, Disney. Actually, 3.5 and a heart. We got the half star. It's like better. It's just not. I think a lot of the reviews at the time pointed to this as well. It's not very substantive.
Yeah. I think people said, like, okay, it's like all the other talking animal Disneys, you know?
Right.
I think if they had let it be what the younger animators wanted it to be, like, it would have had a better... Well, but it is weird to me, though, because it is still remembered as, like, a dark Disney.
Absolutely. And it's crazy. I mean, they follow this up with The Black Cauldron, which is, some people say, the darkest. In some ways, I think this is darker.
I have to see, like, Black Cauldron. Than that.
I don't know. Black Cauldron, it definitely has a darker source material, and the Horned King looks like Skeletor, basically. And there are some pretty realistic depictions of, like, zombies, basically. But I think it's dark, maybe for smaller children, but I think thematically and maybe more tonally, this is darker.
Yeah.
This is like Bambi, but not. This is, I was also thinking about this, like, the Disney animal movies, there's always an assumption, except for this and The Lion King, that the animals will not eat each other, right? Like, all the animals can talk to each other. And they're friends, basically.
Right.
And Bambi, you never see the dogs or the humans. You just hear them. But do you see the dogs? You might see the, like, silhouettes of dogs. But this is, like, kind of grappling with something that the other animal movies don't grapple with, which is, like, some animals eat other animals.
Right. And that is interesting, because it's kind of like, it's similar to, like, Toy Story. Like, it's fun to look at the logic of Toy Story, because it's just a made-up world. Like, but it still has some rules. Like, if you take something... like talking animals that don't have any real world rules other than what we know about animals, it's fun to poke at that.
Right. Yes. And it's not something they ever really get back to. Like, in The Lion King, it's not ignored, certainly, because that's kind of the point of the circle of life, but it's made into this grand metaphor, right?
Right.
And then they never explicitly say, like, they say you go hunting, but they never, like, oh, we eat the hyenas, we eat the elephants.
Right.
Some jokes made at Timon and Pumbaa's expense. But, and then Dinosaur, which comes out quite a bit later, the carnivores in that don't talk.
Huh.
Like, only the omnivores and herbivore dinosaurs talk in that movie. So the carnivores don't even have a chance. Like, that's, I guess, the excuse they can make for them wanting to eat the other dinosaurs.
Did I watch Dinosaur?
Wait, should you or have you?
Should I, in the year of our Lord 2020, should I watch Dinosaur?
20th anniversary. I rewatched it recently. For listeners out there, I mean, I'm doing a Disney rewatch where I'm trying to you know, as the label on the tin says, we watch all the Disney movies, and I recently caught up with Dinosaur, and I was not a fan.
I mean, I don't think there's many fans of Dinosaur. Well,
there's like, not like concerns me. There are bigger concerns in the world, but I feel like there are going to be people who, we're already getting to that time, who think like, yeah, I love Dinosaur as a kid. Let's reclaim Dinosaur, which I just don't think is possible. It hasn't aged as poorly as I thought it would. Like I kind of went into it thinking like, oh geez, the animation is going to look spotty, but I think they didn't animate the landscapes. They used
they animated
the dinosaurs onto real live action backgrounds.
Just kind of what they did with Lion King, right?
New one, yeah, I believe so. And yeah, I don't know the plot. The dinosaurs weak. People always say like the trailer that first came out, like the teaser trailer that came out, is the best part of Dinosaur. And that is like the first 5 minutes.
Oh.
I think they initially also wanted it to be completely nonverbal.
Hmm.
But then they got scared of that, so they made it verbal. But the first 5 minutes pretty much are nonverbal, and it's very reminiscent of like Prince of Egypt. If you've seen that.
I have not. I need to, but
okay.
I always find that.
Do watch that.
I will. I always find that interesting. Like these people, they want to do things like that. They're like, let's make it like a nature documentary. And then I haven't seen the new Lion King, but from all reports, that's what they do. And people hated it. Well, people saw it, but most critics were like, this sucks. Like there's no emotion. Like,
plus, like it's like, I just don't understand them. I haven't heard that nature documentary thing before, but I just feel like that's very hard to reconcile with a movie that is a musical.
Is Dinosaur a music? Or, oh, Lion King?
Oh, no, sorry. Lion King, sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's just, that's just kind of how they treat it. Like, they're like, let's make them as realistic as possible. Like, you need something, you know?
I'm not a fan of that. I just, to me, animation is a medium where you can do things you cannot do in real life, even if it is animation in the sense of Lion King, where it looks, like, I don't get the need for photorealism in animation, right? Yeah. And, like, you lose so much of the expressiveness, and I haven't seen the new Lion King, but I assume that I Just Can't Wait to Be King montage.
Oh,
song.
I've seen this part. I can give a quick little story. One night in college, I came home drunk from a party, and I was like, you know, me being a drunk film nerd, I was like, I'm gonna watch Lion King. So I turned it on. I don't remember a second of it. I just remember looking over and seeing horrific, like realistic, like warthogs like singing at me. And
that's not
and like
that's not fun.
It wasn't. And all I remember is during I Can't Wait to Be King, I was throwing up. Like I was like,
oh, boy.
I don't throw up often, but like there's sometimes like I just want to go to sleep. Like I don't want to be drunk anymore. And so I literally was like putting my fingers in my throat. I was like, I want it out. I just want to go to sleep.
I just can't wait to be asleep.
Yeah. And like while that song's going, it's just me like, like it was.
Oh, geez.
It was pretty surreal.
So you only really remember barfing during it?
Yeah.
I in the movie, that's like, they do, like, The Lion King plays around with color a lot, but
yeah,
not like one scene that's like, and you know, Can You Feel the Love Tonight as well. Like, that's the scene where they kind of go, you know, it's very brightly colored. The plants don't look like they normally do. It's not a very naturalistic thing. So I just can't even imagine what that sequence would look like realistic.
Well, and that's like, that's what you can do with animation. Like, that's what.
Exactly.
100%. That's what I love about, like, older Disney's. It's like the colors will just randomly, like, oh, everything's yellow and purple and blue. Like, that doesn't matter. Like, you still understand.
Like, that's a tree. And I almost want. And there's such. I feel like another part of kind of like the Disney lore throughout, or the animated Disney lore, at least throughout the years, has been a shying away from trying to do newer things. Or I guess it depends how well the studio is doing at the time. Because you really do get so much experimentation, especially in the early years. And I think a lot of that is driven by Walt.
Yeah.
But then you have Sleeping Beauty, which at the time was a bomb. Well, it wasn't a bomb, but it didn't make enough money. It didn't make the money it needed to make. And that's kind of why the animation starts to look so different post Sleeping Beauty.
Well, while we're generally talking about Disney, I think we should bring up more generally what this podcast is so people know what to expect in the future. So we're Vaulting the Wall direct to sequel podcast. It's a good name. Don't make fun of it. We spent a lot of time making that name.
It's a good name.
I like the name. It's a mouthful, but whatever. It's
versatile. Yeah.
So basically, we are covering the direct-to-video sequels to Disney movies that happened, like 90s into the aughts?
Yeah, basically, it's basically like, I think Return of Jafar is 94.
Yeah.
And it goes until, when is Planes? To the early 2010s. Well, I mean, it really hits its stride in like the 2000s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true. I forgot we're doing all the way up to Planes for some reason.
Because we hit ourselves.
Planes technically isn't direct to video, but you know, it's similar.
Yeah, we're making, there are some exceptions, and we'll get to those when
we'll get to them when we get to them. We run the podcast, not you.
Our rules.
We decide
what we're covering.
If we want to cover
Buzz Lightyear,
if we want to cover Christopher Nolan randomly, we're gonna do it.
we'll see about that.
Vaulting the Wall, random episode. Oh, on The Dark Knight Rises, the worst one? That's weird. Why is this in my pod feed?
Because enough people haven't already made podcasts about Christopher Nolan, right?
Yeah.
It's totally unexplored territory.
I think I want to say something controversial here. I think I want to say that Joker guy, he's no good.
No. but honestly, yeah. So we're basically looking at most of the Disney Toon movies. Some of these, there's a few on the list that were co-creations with Disney TV animation, but for the majority, they are Disney Toon sequels.
You might have been able to tell from this, but I kind of don't know what I'm talking about. but I wanted to come along on the ride. And
you suggested it. You wanted to start the ride. You hopped in the cart and said, let's go.
Built the roller coaster.
You did.
Without knowing what the roller coaster was. But it's because I like knowing a lot of things about things that people don't care about usually. So I could have watched the Renaissance movies and done all that. But no, I want to watch the direct-to-video sequels because I want to know about those. And you do know about them.
I do know about them. I was very much a Disney kid growing up. In some ways, I feel like I have stronger attachments to some of the sequels than kind of like the canon movies. I was like a kid when these were coming out and when they were,
right.
I was the target audience. So,
and I was also a kid when a lot of these were coming out, but when I was a kid, like, I don't know what I did. Honestly, I just played with Legos and like, screamed at rocks. Like, I don't know. I didn't consume much media as a kid. I think I watched like some DreamWorks stuff a lot. I ended up on the wrong side of animation.
Oh boy. I was a media junkie, if we're comparing. I watched a lot of Disney movies as a kid.
Huh. Yeah, so that's kind of the dynamic. I'll try to come in with stuff. I won't go in completely blind, but in general, I'm kind of the guy who doesn't know what's going on as much.
I'm the girl who knows what's going on a little bit more.
Wait, also, we never like introduced ourselves.
Oh, did we ever introduce ourselves? Oh boy, this is why it's the pilot. I'm KT.
Okay, I'm Sam.
And this is
Yeah, this is a podcast. How long have we been going? Like an hour?
About an hour and like, I don't know, we had that technical problem, so
yeah,
an hour and 10 minutes maybe.
I don't, should we go longer or should we call? I don't know, like,
I think we're pretty good. Do you maybe want to say what next week's topic will be?
Next week we are covering the first of the probably the most famous, I'd say. This is the one people joke about, I feel like.
Really?
Well, I always, when people bring up the direct-to-video sequels, people always say this one. And the thing they always say is The Return of Jafar.
Mm-hmm. He's back.
He's back, baby.
He's pissed.
What's that movie? What's the dinosaur movie where the taglines, "We're back"?
That's the name of the movie. It's "We're Back," semicolon, a dinosaur's tale. Or colon, not a semicolon.
We're back.
That's just the name of the movie, which is also a very strange movie.
Maybe we should cover "We're Back."
one thing at a time. But
John Goodman in it.
John Goodman is in it. It's a crazy movie. I remember liking it as a kid, but I was a child. I didn't have ideas yet.
Yeah, children are dumb. Hot take. But yeah, we're doing Return of Jafar.
Yeah, Return of Jafar, the first of the two Aladdin sequels.
Yeah.
In my opinion, the worst.
Oh.
I'll save it for the pod.
Someone told me Return of Jafar had bangers, but...
I have the VHS tape and I remember watching it, but I think I far preferred the second Aladdin sequel. So I don't remember a lot about it.
Well, you mentioned to me off mic, you were like, when was the last time you saw Aladdin? And I looked it up. I haven't seen the original Aladdin in years.
We're going to have fun with this one.
Well, I don't know. Should I rewatch Aladdin or should I just jump into the sequel?
It's a good movie. I mean, I feel like anytime you ask me if I should watch or if you should watch a Renaissance one, I'm just going to be like, it's a good movie, Sam.
Yeah, I'll watch Aladdin. I gotta watch Aladdin.
I mean, especially since this is the one Aladdin sequel that doesn't use Robin Williams as Genie.
Oh, yeah,
we'll get into that.
Compare it.
Yeah. You might want to refresh your Genie knowledge.
Yeah, because the most recent Aladdin I've seen is the 2019 remake, and that's Will Smith.
That's a completely different guy.
That's a different human being.
Yep, completely different.
So yeah, this has been Vaulting the Walt.
Thank you for joining us on our pilot episode.
Yeah,